Bible presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Dar Williams. In our conversation, Dar tells us about her name and starting on clarinet before starting on guitar following her sisters. Dar describes her new album, Hummingbird Highway, and how she went about writing the songs for the album. Dar discusses her first guitar and her guitars she plays now, a Collings, a Mahogany Martin, and a Husson Dalton, and a Martin Joan Baez that was gifted to Dar by Joan. Dar talks about touring for the new record in 2026 and her speaking and retreat schedule where she teaches songwriting skills and what her touring band looks like. Dar describes her college years studying both religion and theater and what it was like growing up an hour north of New York City. Dar takes us through the process she went through to get a record deal and how she maintains her voice on the road. And finally, Dar tells us about what she does during her downtime. To find out more about Dar, you can go to her website, darwilliams.com. That's DARWILLIAMS.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my friend Dar.
Hello.
Hi. How are you, Dar?
Oh, I'm good.
How come your parents nicknamed you Dar rather than Snow?
Oh, you know, a few reasons. My mom really loves Pride and Prejudice, so I think it was Darcy.
Okay.
And that's a dude. But my sisters were like, let's just stick with Dar. And then also, I think we were going to give my son that nickname, that middle name. And my dad was like, you know, actually Snowden, it's your middle name. But like, he was a problematic guy. so anyway, I think there was some, you know, ancestral extended family ambivalence about my great, great, great uncle. Lovely, lovely man in many ways.
Very good. Was guitar your primary instrument early on, or was piano your primary instrument?
I gave the clarinet like 2 months.
Okay.
And then, I don't play the piano.
Okay.
So, yeah, my sister played guitar, and, you know, I wanted to do everything my sisters did.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Of course. So I heard the new album, and it's wonderful. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's gorgeous. The instrumentalists beside yourself on the album, who are they?
Gosh, I don't know all of their last names. But my big sort of the guy that I work with, there's the guitarist is Rich Hinman, who you might know. And the person that I've been touring with since 2008, who provided a lot of the keyboard parts, was Bryn Roberts, who is he and I wrote a song together in a long time ago. And then I said, I think it's important for you to keep on being in the studio, and, you know, you get me. And so a lot of like the primary motifs of the record were sort of constructed by him. So that's Bryn Roberts, and he's got he's got many degrees in all sorts of jazz and composition.
Sure. When you're songwriting, do you come up with like a chord pattern first and then the lyrics, or do you come up with the lyrics first and then a chord pattern, or is it something completely different than all of that?
It's, you know, ideally there's some phrase, like I had a song called I Had No Right. And all I had in my mind was, I had no right. and I kept on going, I had no right. And it was like this chord pattern, and it all came at once in my head. And then I constructed a whole song that had to do with like adolescence. And I was like, oh, I'm so bored with writing about my adolescence. And so is everybody else. And so my brain went to this place like, well, who else, you know, I had no right. And I thought about the Berrigan brothers, who were priests who were, you know, went to jail a lot for, nonviolent resistance actions. So I wrote sort of a verse account of this thing called The Trial of the Catonsville Nine, which so is a completely different song, but based on sort of like, this is a mystery. I had no right. You know, what do I do? Like, and I have a song called If I Wrote You. I'm like, if I wrote you, what? You know, and so that's the ideal. But then I realized actually, probably if I had to choose, I start with music and then I kind of look to see what interior world, Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Like, what's awakened thematically that's interesting to me in that, in that world that suddenly pops out of the pattern? Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the third song that I can't pronounce the name of it. But like, have you studied bossa nova previously to this? Yeah.
No. In fact, I was talking to Bryn. I'm totally going to out myself. I was talking to Bryn and I was like, you know, I've been listening to a lot of samba songs and bossa nova songs. It seems more bossa nova than samba. And Bryn, who, you know, knows this stuff back and forth, said, actually, bossa nova is a very conscious fusion of American jazz and Brazilian samba.
Oh, wow.
That's why you get the more croony, you know, jazzy Frank Sinatra stuff is going to be more of a bossa nova. I was like, oh, yeah, that's why, because, you know, really my reference points are obviously, you know, it's very, I just think of French accordions and stuff.
Sure.
And it was sort of a French song, but the French sort of looking back and winking at American / Brazilian bossa nova. Yeah. So it all made sense.
Do you speak French?
Badly. Okay. I mean, I took a bunch of it, you know, like I took it in high school and I took it in college for a bit, but I started to write it in all French and I'm like, who are you kidding? Yeah. So it couldn't, especially since it's really idiomatic, you know, so I went with just the sprinkling of, but it was, I kind of wrote it with a French accent in my head.
Sure.
So,
yeah. And you mentioned your sisters and they played guitar. When did you actually start playing guitar yourself?
When I was nine.
Oh, wow.
And it was amazing because the next year I went to summer camp and it was one of those things where, you know, you show up with your guitar in that little cardboard box and,
oh, yeah.
You know, that really cheap case. And they're like, take it out. Oh, my gosh, you play guitar. And I remember singing Got to Get You Into My Life for the, you know, and like really rocking it when I was 10.
Wow.
And the counselors, you know, just dancing in the background screaming. It's sort of like, wow, if you do this, the world is open to you. And what a fantastic thing to start playing so young and have that.
Yeah. Do you remember what brand the first guitar was? Or nameless nylon string guitar?
Nameless nylon string guitar that my mom got for probably about $10.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Why? Well, don't be sorry. And now, are you playing like majority of is the Callings?
Yes. Yeah. This Callings cutaway that I have. It's funny. It was kind of down for the count, and it was the B string, and this fellow. Person said, a fellow guitar player said, mm-hmm. You know why it's called the B string? Because it's a bitch.
Oh.
I took it to a person who said, oh, I think you're stringing it wrong. Oh, it's just not laying across the nut correctly. Huh. There's very little I can do because it's your fault. And then another friend said, you don't finger your chords correctly. And I'm like, okay, maybe, but I will sell this guitar if we can't do this because I've addressed all of these things.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I brought it to a guy who's like a lawyer who loves this stuff. And he was like, let's see what we got here. And he found the problem. And now it's my full time again on the road when I'm just bringing one guitar. So I have that. And I have a Huss and Dalton Sunburst that they made for me, sort of a parlor sized guitar.
Yeah.
A little bigger. And then I got a beautiful straight ahead Martin mahogany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the OM-17 or something like that?
Yeah. And like a lot of it, I lead a songwriting retreat and like everybody else had it, which was wonderful, you know, because it's such a beautiful workhorse.
Oh, yeah.
And I was happy to play that for a couple of years. But now, yeah, the Callings.
Yeah. And do you have onboard electronics on them or do you just like, okay. Do you know what it is?
Bags.
Oh,
for the
LR
Callings,
bags.
I believe. Yeah. I'm not sure. Gosh, it was so long ago. you know, when they made the guitar at Hudson Dalton, they put in the system. And I thought that was Bags too, but that was the other thing. The Collings went through a few pickup fixes as well. But yeah, if you have recommendations, I'm all ears, because people feel very strongly.
Oh, yeah. Well, the K&K is the one that it's passive, but it has more of a acoustic sound to it than some of the other ones, and it's also less intrusive. Like, there's not a whole bunch of hardware inside of it. It's just so that's the one that I use.
You're like the 10th person who's, that's why I asked. So you know, it's one of those things that's to the back of my mind, and you're helping it get to the front of my mind. So I've got that. I also have a Joan Baez limited edition guitar, but I don't bring that on the road with me.
From Martin.
She gave it to me. Yeah, oh, wow. It's her Martin.
Yeah, yeah. And wow, that's special.
I think I got 59 of 59. Uh-huh. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's great. That's fantastic.
It's been, amazing.
Yeah. And you've played with Joan Baez, like, she's recorded some of your songs, is that correct?
Yes. We did one as a duet, and then she recorded two others, which was really astounding. Yeah. And I, you know, they show up on my royalty statements. Like, oh, there she is.
Right on.
Yeah.
That's great. And you famously played at Alcatraz with her?
I did. That was her sister's organization.
For Bread and Roses.
Bread and Roses, which was a perfect match. And that was when I met the Indigo Girls in her kitchen. And now it's, you know, I've known them. I've seen them all around the world at this point. Yeah. So that was, she's a connector. Oh. So the first place we connected was Alcatraz, and then we've done other things. Yeah.
Yeah. And so on your calendar, there's not a lot of tour dates yet. Are you planning on doing a tour to support the new album?
Yeah, I've got some health stuff going on. So that's this year. And then next year, or maybe even in December, I'm going to get back out there. But we've got a huge tour for 2026.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, summer is almost over anyway, so.
Yeah.
And are you still doing your speaking apart from the health problems?
No, I'm just taking some time off and then coming back on in online. But yeah, I might do some online retreats for new people. Like, I do an online retreat for, you know, a normal retreat for a weekend right after the new year starts. But then I always have a couple of online just for new people things. So I'll do those. And you know, I'm involved with a thrift sale in my town, so I'll be busy at home.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. The retreats, they're songwriting retreats, I assume.
Yeah. It's called How to Write It. No, sorry. I have a book. It's called How to Write a Song That Matters. And the retreat is called Writing a Song That Matters.
Okay.
Which I lead in Connecticut, which is, I've been doing it for like 13, 14 years now.
Wow.
It's a really meaningful part of my life at this point.
Sure, sure, sure.
So keeps my brain going.
And so you've mentioned college. Your songs are very certainly, there's, like you mentioned earlier, there's ones that are definitely based in history. Did you spend a lot of time studying history in college?
No. I was a religion and theater major. Really? So actually, I have theater history and religion history. So the Berrigans, and there's actually a song called And a God Descended, which is actually based on a book called Satan and Goree, by Isaac Bolshevitz Singer, which is about like a false messianic movement. And it's just like, it was such genius how he got everybody to just completely degrade themselves in the name of, like, the logic was really pure. And I thought, oh, how intense that a person could figure out how to get people to be the opposite of everything they believed in the name of everything they believed in. So like, that stuff's really interesting to me. So
oh, of course.
some of that history stuff, the religious history shows up, I think.
Yeah. So theater and religion seems like opposite ends of, like, you know, the entertainment industry in a way. was that planned, or do you have a religious background?
No, actually my parents didn't go to church, and I was really interested in that stuff. So I went to Sunday school in second grade and at the Presbyterian church. Then I started going to the Quaker Meeting House Sunday school because I had a crush on the Sunday school teacher's son.
Okay.
and I loved her so much. She was so groovy. And, you know, she got me down from, like, long bearded, you know, old God to, like, a Jerry Garcia type God in my mind, which was a huge service, you know, to my soul. And then I went to an Episcopalian youth group. So I was just, and I was like, wow, it's so interesting the way these people believe and what they believe. And,
yeah.
And then of course I went to school and learned about Buddhism and Judaism and Islam. And, it was just endless. So that's why.
Yeah. But
so I'm interested in, like, why people believe in what they believe in, but which is like what theater is too.
Yeah.
I mean, telling a story is kind of figuring out how people, you know, tell themselves.
Exactly.
So it's just similar in my mind.
Yeah. Oh, great. That's fantastic. What was, so you grew up in upstate New York? Am I correct or close?
About an hour north of New York City. It's like,
okay.
Don't say upstate if, you know,
yeah.
In Albany, they'll, like, stone you if you say that you grew up. But yeah, along the Hudson River, yeah.
Okay. And what was it like when you were growing up in that area? Was it all small towns for the most part?
It was a it changed really fast, and I caught a really lucky, like, a lucky wave, because I was, you know, born in the late 60s, and then the 70s, kind of everywhere, was just a, I don't know, like, it was kind of like the laboratory of the 60s. So people were, I remember my mom cooked something like vegetarian for us, and we're like, ugh, disgusting, don't do that again. And, but, you know, she tried, and people were doing yoga.
Sure.
There was a head shop in the middle of our town.
Wow.
And there was an initiative that my dad started to create, like, a really huge library. We all got involved with the library.
Wow.
And they expected everybody. They brought out a huge table of instruments to try at the school. And then they told you, okay, if you want to try it, bring it home and just bring it back whenever.
Yeah. Wow.
Because you're going to play an instrument, right? And my sister came home with a violin. So she actually doesn't play guitar. She did violin. And
okay.
And she came home in tears because she didn't know if my mom would believe that, like, she got to bring a violin home. But it was the 70s. You know, it's like, yeah. Oh, you're going to play an instrument, right? You're going to play with other people. You're going to jam. And that was really in the air. And then in 1980, it all kind of clamped down and got really wealthy because we had a lot of people on Wall Street and stuff. So, you know, you started to see the three-car garages and the McMansions and stuff. And it got much more uptight in some ways. And it was interesting. But our teachers were still hippies. And they were like, man, something's really messed up in this town. Like, your parents are really messed up. And, like, you're going to be messed up too, I bet. And we were like, we're not. And sure enough, like, most of us became, like, folk singers and therapists.
Oh, wow.
And public school teachers and professors. Like, all my friends took sort of a, you know, a pastoral route.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of my friends went into, like, finance, but, so it was cool. It was a lazy town surrounded by a bunch of other lazy towns. And then it became a really uptight town.
Oh, wow.
And then everybody else kind of followed suit. It's in Westchester County, which is just, like, you know, it's, I mean, tons of fantastic people and a lot of hippies and stuff, but, it was different back in the head shop days.
Oh yeah. For sure. And how did you go from, I imagine that you were writing songs early on, that, how did you get a record deal? How would you get noticed to get a record deal, that is?
It was so different, you know, I mean, just so different. in the 90s. But I knew, I didn't, there was a really healthy like ecosystem of major labels and also boutique labels. Mm-hmm. And then you had Ani DiFranco doing her own thing.
Sure.
And you had Prince, you know, yeah, famously saying, this is really messed up. So I kind of saw the whole world out there, and and so we were kind of looking at indie labels. There's a beautiful one called Red House that was made around sort of Greg Brown's music, and there was Rounder out of Boston.
Sure.
My manager had managed Elliot Smith, who okay. not Elliot Smith, not Elliot. I'm sorry, not Elliot Smith. I'm sorry. Anyway, he was friends with these guys at a label called Razor and Tie.
Okay.
And Razor and Tie were these guys who did reissues of like disco music and stuff.
Yep.
Kind of like what Bronco did, but they really went for it with repackaging stuff, and they bought the rights to a bunch of catalogs of artists, and they were just kind of growing in that world. They would have like their friends put on like disco clothes and take pictures of them. I mean, it's like super, you know, these guys from Ohio State University just throwing it at the wall, but they did well. And they're like, we want to work with developing artists, and we're working with Graham Parker and Marshall Crenshaw. And who is this like little hairy legged hippie kid who jumps out of her tiny Honda and plays songs in coffee houses? And they said, look, I already had a great manager, and my managers, two managers, and they hooked me up with a really prestigious folk booking agency who had just lost an artist. And they were like, you know, let's all work hard. We don't think we can make you into a star, but like we'll work hard and you'll work hard, yeah, and let's see how far we go. And we went really far in a year.
Uh-huh.
So Razor and Ty was like, okay, she's on the radar. She'll work hard. We'll work hard. And they were like, wow, sending posters off to a church basement. Okay. And the booking agency was like, you know, oh, doing a tip jar gig contract. Haven't done that one before, but it was that thing of like this intrepid team that, I mean, I just lucked out, yeah, and it turned out extremely well. I wrote a song called When I Was a Boy, and that was kind of getting into a weird like gender conversation that, sure, has only really emerged, surfaced, but it was like really in people's guts, you know, in their hearts. And that's, I think, what got me the trust of my first audiences, like when I would open for Joan and, yeah, Arlo Guthrie and Ani, you know, they were like, oh, well, if she can write that song, we'll listen to her other songs. Yeah. So really that one song also opened the door to that world of record labels and attention that it's very much harder for younger folks to get now.
Yeah. Of course. Of course. How much time when you're touring, how much time do you spend supporting people like, you know, like the Arlo Guthries or the Ani DiFrancos, or playing, you know, your own venues and you know theaters and stuff?
I would say 90% my own thing.
Okay.
But I did do a supporting tour for Bruce Coburn in 2023. And that was astounding. I mean, like, that was, you know, if somebody just said, you know, why don't you pay a bunch of money to go open for this guy and watch him from the wings and hang out with his crew and hang out with him. I mean, he's astounding. And so that was a real dream. And then I did a split bill tour, actually, with Amy Ray's band,
okay,
in 2024. So she has a thing aside from the Indigo Girls, and she was so great. She's like, I'm just kind of putting it out there, and you have these venues on the West Coast that we would like to be playing too, like that we've had offers at. Why don't we do this together and kind of zing off of each other? And
wow.
It was kind of a dream thing too.
Sure. That's great. And when you do these things, when you're touring by yourself, and this is the question, when you're touring as yourself, are you bringing a band or is it just you and a guitar?
A lot of them, I bring Bryn along, Bryn Roberts. And then a lot of them are solo. I would say a lot of them are solo. And then the band tour is going to be a trio.
Okay.
Wow. You know, for the album release. Yeah.
And trio being you, the keyboardist, and who else?
Ward Williams plays guitar and cello. Okay. And so electric, acoustic, cello. And the keyboard player is Seth Glear, who is a singer-songwriter in his own right.
Okay.
He's going to join and which is great because Bryn is actually a teacher at Interlochen, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. And being on the East Coast, did you ever give any thought to going to Berklee College of Music?
You know, I was only in Boston for like a few years, and then I went out to Northampton, which is a world away, even though it's Western Mass.
Yeah.
And then I was New York, and I just didn't. A lot of my friends are there, but it seems like they kind of went with regional. Melissa Ferrick was there. Paula Cole is there. Mm-hmm. And my friend Matt Smith, who runs Passim. And I know people down here who come up there, but it just didn't interest me to do so. And I don't think they want me. I don't think I'm not. And that's okay. But I don't think like I didn't. We did not pursue each other, and sure. I think that's fine. But I mean, Berklee is the goal. I mean, the big joke used to be like the gold, like the perfect moment is when you get the person who dropped out of Berklee.
Oh, of course, yes.
somehow I kept on getting people who dropped out, but then I also worked with people who went the whole way through. But the great thing about Berklee is that the musicians out of there, not only do they know things backwards and forwards the way Bryn does, it's also their ability to get along on the road, you know, just to really, I don't know if there's a course called like drink the coffee you're given, you know, but there's an amazing professionalism about how they were as people to travel with. Like it's like no prima donna at all, and that's a huge gift, like everybody really working hard to get along, and I work hard to get along with people it makes for an incredible tour.
When you're doing your own tours, are you traveling, is it all fly dates, or are you in a bus, or are you in a van?
Sometimes a van. We had a gigantic SUV. I was like, ugh, nice look. But, it was the best way to go for one of them. But Sprinter vans are the best.
Oh, yeah.
But mostly it's just me and my car. I have an electric car. Okay. So, and I'm a big advocate because, like, I just did a solo tour that went all the way out to New Mexico and looped around. It was 5,500 miles, and it was in my electric car, like, charging the whole way.
Wow.
And that was last November. And I mean, they're like, you got to plan it. But if you're traveling with a dog, you know, or with a kid, which I've done, you know, it's like not as hard as that, you know, or even traveling with a grumpy boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, like you have to be a planner. And so it was fantastic. I avoid flying as much as possible just because of the planet.
Yeah.
Like, I really do everything I can to. I've driven to Chicago and North Carolina and everybody on my team tries to route me accordingly.
Yeah, of course. That's great. That's fantastic. How do you maintain your voice, like, when you're doing these, like, you know, when you're touring, how do you maintain your voice?
My old voice teacher, Justina, was like, if you're breathing correctly and warming up and singing correctly, maintenance is not going to be an issue.
Okay.
And Joan said this, actually, a couple of people, including Joan Baez, along the way have said, you know, make sure you check in with a voice teacher, make sure that you are sort of up to date on all the things you can be doing to protect your voice.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to heed that advice any day now. But I haven't had a problem. You know, I'm possibly a little rough the next day here and there, but by the showtime, there's not an issue.
Oh, good. Good. Do you warm up ahead of before the show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I put on my makeup.
Okay. Yeah. And that, to be fair, you have a much stronger voice than Joan does.
Actually, her voice is, you know, has deepened.
Oh, it has.
So arguably, it's kind of like, you know, maybe I can hear how deep the cave is. she's also, you know, retired.
Yeah,
I mean, so maybe in her last years, a few of my friends are out there and you can hear some of the years on their voice, which you'll hear in my voice in 15 years too.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think they're pretty strong.
Yeah. And do you plan on, how long do you plan on keep touring? I'm not going to say keep singing because, and songwriting, because I'm sure you're going to do that forever, but but touring, how long do you think you'll keep doing that?
I think in my early 70s, I'm going to see where
fair.
I'm at.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, I know people who are like, I have friends in there. I mean, Bruce is in his early 80s now.
Sure.
And he was, I don't know if he was nominated for a Grammy. He was definitely nominated for a Juno for his last album. And that's kind of a kick in the ass for the likes of me. And Tom Rush has albums that he's put out that are great. And Jorma Kaukinen is out there. Mm-hmm. So, and they're in their 80s. So, and Judy Collins has been putting out albums. She's in her mid 80s.
Yeah.
So, I think, there's no excuse, except I just think in my early 70s, I'm going to want to kind of get off the bus.
Exactly.
But I like the bus now.
Okay, good. That's great. That's great. And apart from music, you mentioned there's a swap meet, maybe. What do you do for fun outside of music?
I get involved with community stuff. I wrote this book called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, which is about kind of how, as a musician, I've gone to towns and you probably know this too, like it's like towns that feel like their palms are open versus like little balled up fists.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So those are the places where I can sit down and work on a couple of lines of a song, like in a nice coffee house.
Sure.
And where the vibe's good. And so it started with that feeling and then continued into this curiosity about like how towns have this thing I called positive proximity, which is, I define as a state of being in a town where people recognize that living side by side is beneficial. Uh-huh. You know, even if you don't like everybody, you're just like, oh, I get it. You know, we live because we help each other out. And those are the places that will have like a nice fountain and cool school programs and a big sledding hill. And so I looked for what the common denominator of those towns that had positive proximity were. And I learned a lot about social capital and that whole thing in sociology around sort of how we build social trust, social capital, as opposed to financial capital. And I look for it kind of manically, like I'm really interested, but my other friends are too, like other musicians are like, well, that's where the good coffee is. Like the people who have their shit together are, you know, so I foster that where I can in my town, but you can't do it too with like too much sentimentality. You got to kind of find something that automatically kind of brings in the good vibes. And environmentally, like retail, a whole bunch of retail just drives me nuts. And so I started a small thrift sale with a couple of people. It was like 4 hours in the dead of winter, and we made $600.
Wow.
But we kept on learning, and we do it twice a year. And the last one brought in $21,000.
Wow.
And we keep on using our wits and our sense of humor to grow it and advertise it and bring people in. There's so much clothing out there, and we get these beautiful, things with tags on them and stuff, and so beautifully like washed and folded and left on my porch. And, you know, people really like being part of that circle, the circular economy.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And so now that's, we call ourselves the Thrift Alliance, the Cold Spring Thrift Alliance.
Right on.
And yeah, we have a little logo. Is it Omnia Circularia, all things circular. Uh-huh. And it's my community. It's like, you know, the expression Sangha in Buddhism, your spiritual community. It's kind of, I've got my Buddhist community, which is my Sangha, but I also have them, and they're my Sangha. We just came up with a poster last night.
Oh, great. That's fantastic.
It's just, you know, and it brings in a lot of like vibrations in the air that are very, there's something called Zantolo, called ancestor energy, like Day of the Dead energy.
Yeah.
It's there in thrift sales. Oh. So like I surf that. You know, we build it and then we surf it.
That's great. That's fantastic. Well, it's been an honor to speak with you. I'm glad that.
You too.
Yeah, this Thank is great. You. I appreciate it. And it's and like I said, I really enjoy the album. The album is fantastic.
I'm so glad. Thank you, because, you know, not many people have heard it. So that's music to all of our ears. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And if you make it out to, I'm in Northern California. If you make it out here, I'd love to come see you play.
I was in Arcata, like 2 or 3 years ago. Okay. So I make it out there. I love Mendocino, Arcata, all of that. Is that where you are? Are you on the coast or inland?
I'm in Napa. So not that far.
Oh, you're Napa. Oh, I get to Napa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
Okay, great.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar, Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.